welcome to the 17th episode of Season 4 of the Ubuntu UK podcast. It's Tuesday the 11th of October 2011, and in this episode we are going to talk about Ubuntu 11.10 and the state of the Ubuntu community. We will of course cover the latest news, events, a bit about Ubuntu, command line love, and go over your feedback. I'm Tony, and with me this week are Laura, Alan, and Mark.
Hello.
So, hello.
Hello.
Hello. So,
Laura, what have you been up to recently?
I went to visit my parents and I inherited a new netbook.
A new netbook?
No, not a new netbook. I inherited a netbook that's new to me.
Okay.
So it's now running Natty.
Ooh.
Or it was running Natty anyway, but it now has fan silencer of some sort on it, so it's not too loud to use during the podcast.
Is it that one there?
It's this one here.
That's the same as this one here, isn't it?
It's the same as Tony's one over there.
Oh, that one. Yes. Okay.
Mine is a different one.
Oh, yeah. Laptop twins.
So, yes, and I found a pop-up book from the 80s about how the inside
of
the personal computer, which I don't think Alan's seen yet.
Oh, God.
It's really
is he going to jump out?
Keep him quiet for hours.
Brilliant. Brilliant.
The primary colours.
Wow. It's got 3D and everything.
It's pop-up. Wow.
It is pop-up.
It's book. Inside the personal computer.
You don't even need those funny glasses.
And there are even videos of it on YouTube I discovered today.
Videos of a book?
Of a book. Because wow. It's just lots of people of my age, presumably, are finding them.
Does everyone say the book is better than the film?
Yeah.
Right, that's Alan busy for the next few minutes. Mark, while I was playing with this toy, tell us what you've been about.
After last week's discussion, I've been sorting out my backups so that if I accidentally delete things again, I can get them back, which is nice.
You reckon you can get them back?
I can get
how
them back.
Certain?
Why are you sorting them out? What was wrong with them?
I didn't have them. Well, I did have them, but then they failed, and then I didn't realise they'd failed until it was too late for me to do anything about it.
Always
basically.
The way.
So now I've got a fairly reliable and secure-ish system.
Your confidence is just
I'm confident enough that I'm using it. Let's put it that way.
Okay, that sounds good. You were using your rubbish one before. It didn't work.
Yeah, but this is much better than that one.
Okay.
You see the confidence in him.
Alan, are you able to talk to us?
Yeah.
Good, good.
Why
you were gesticulating frantically at us before that you weren't quite ready.
No. I don't know what you're talking about.
So what have you been doing?
I don't know. What have I been doing? Let me look at the document and see what I've been doing.
It says here.
What have I been doing?
Etherwake.
Etherwake, yeah. I wanted to do the usual reduced power consumption at home. So shut down machines and then when I want to use one, wake it up and use it and then power it down again. And I had right trouble. I had no problems getting the Mac to do it, the running Ubuntu. But before you all jump on me, but my desktop PC wouldn't wake. And I was trying all kinds of, you know, Etherwake and I was making sure I got the right Mac address and all that kind of stuff. And it just wouldn't work. And I thought I'd got it enabled in the BIOS and I went looking for BIOS updates and this kind of stuff. And then someone pointed out there's a command called ftool that you can run on Linux.
Oh, yeah.
And ftool has an option that allows you to enable wake on LAN to turn it on the network card. And I didn't realize that it wasn't turned on in the network card, even though it was turned on in the BIOS. So
worked.
I had to run this command to make it all enabled. And now I can wake my laptop up, my machine at home up from work, which is nice.
Is that persistent across reboots? I guess it must be, because it's shut down.
I woke it up from suspend. So not from shutdown.
All right, okay.
But yeah, that was good. Oh, and I've been learning Vi.
Why?
Hey!
Sorry, Vi, all right, before we get feedback about that. I did learn it ages ago, but then I really felt...
Then you realised there are better ways for editors to work?
Yeah, I've got a short amount of time on this planet. Why should I learn Vi? The thing is, right, I get... There's all the people who sit around me at work, and they all use Vi.
Peer pressure.
There is a bit.
Felt inadequate.
No, I felt that when I go over to their machine, they go, oh, can you have a look at this? And I go over to the machine and they're in Vi.
You go, WQ.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what I do. I quit and then start Nano and edit the same file in Nano and I feel better and I can do it faster. But then I see them like with keyboard shortcuts and stuff doing magical stuff and I think I should really just learn that.
It's editor envy really, isn't it?
It is a bit, yeah. A skill set envy, yeah. You know, all kinds of things. So I've remove Nano from all my machines, and on the one machine that I share with someone else who demanded that I put Nano back on the machine, I just aliased Nano to Vi on my machine.
I'm sure he was chuffed by that.
No, just for my user.
Oh, right, okay.
I'm the only one who has to use Vi.
I was taught that I had to learn the basics of Vi just because on some machines that's all you'll find.
That's true.
Yeah.
Is it?
It's not a problem I've come across very often, to be honest, in a desktop. No. But
and every machine where that would be the case, I would have apt-get. Just get another editor.
What if you're trying to sort out your internet connection, you have to edit or text files manually?
Or apt-get.
I have used kind of cut-down distros where there's only via, I think, Smoothwall or IPCOP.
Yeah, I think that's what he was getting at.
But the thing is, I can get by. I can open Vi. At the moment, my skill set is I can open Vi, insert, append, overwrite, and delete lines.
Yep, that's what I could do.
And I can go to the top and the bottom of a file.
Oh, I can't do that.
Double G and big G. Okay. Yeah, those are the ones you need. But any more than that, like delete a word or jump to the end of the line, I hold the cursor key down. And then I get messed up when some versions of Vi don't use the cursor keys. You have to use J, K, and all that kind of stuff.
Learn to play NetHack.
Is that what helps, is it?
Yeah. Because the controls, it's learning, editing a file in Vi uses the same sort of paradigms that playing NetHack does. So, like, when in NetHack, if you want to attack something five times, you press five and then you press attack. And similarly in Vi.
You don't have to go into attack mode first by pressing escape, colon, A.
Not quite, but no, similarly in Vi or Vim, you want to delete five words, you say D5W and it deletes five words. So it's a similar sort of idea, and you have the same movement keys as well.
I'm glad I didn't have to play a game to learn gedit.
So basically, if you do that, you have enough spare time if you have a social life, you can actually learn Vi.
If you have enough spare time to play NetHack.
If you use your spare time to play NetHack, yes.
Yeah.
Okay, right. I suppose we've been.
Oh, and Tony, what have you been doing?
Okay, I went to New York for my friend's wedding and it was good. And cool. I took photographs and they were good.
Cool.
Excellent. Are you going to write a blog post that people are going to complain about?
Yeah, I will. Yes.
Oh, no, you've already done that.
Yes. Right, let's get on with the show.
It's just 2 days till the release of Ubuntu 11.10. That's Oneric. Let's talk about it. Oh,
okay.
Nice Alice band.
Yeah, Alan's hair is special right now.
Thanks very much.
Right, so what's new in Oneric Ocelot?
Oneric. I think it's Oneric. Alan Bell's been having fun getting the sound thing to say Oneric properly, audibly, and that's been quite hard. But apparently it's Oneric.
Oneric.
Yeah. Two more days and then we haven't got to say the stupid name anymore.
We'll just say.
No, well, and there's never ever going to be another stupid name that we have to say. More on that later. Well, so the first thing is 11.04 was the first release where we have the new Unity. It's not the first release with Unity, but it's the first one with the new Compiz-based Unity.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And now we've got another release with it, but it's more polished, works better. I'd like to say it crashes less.
Does it?
I'd like to.
Right, okay.
In my experience, that's not been the case.
Right, okay.
But I file bugs when it has, so, been a good boy.
Yeah, well done. And there's no more old GNOME to fall back on anymore, is it? It's going away.
When you say old GNOME, we mean GNOME 2.x, the two-panel style.
Yeah, in 11.04, we can choose to log in as Ubuntu Classic, which is old GNOME.
Yes.
So that's going.
Yes, Classic GNOME is gone, and it's Unity 3D is the default, and if your machine's not capable of 3D, or if it's low spec, or if you just want to choose to, you can run Unity 2D.
What's the difference between 3D and 2D?
1D.
Oh, dear.
Galloping over
Tony
the hill.
Got
that
by a minuscule.
I let you finish first. One of them requires 3D accelerated hardware. So that would be like an NVIDIA or an ATI card or a bog standard Intel card would probably do it.
Is that the default?
Yes.
Even in Natty?
Yes.
Ooh.
So how's the
and so you now know that your machine does 3D because you had Unity in Natty. Yes.
And it was quite slow, or it is fairly slow at times.
Can be, yeah. I find it the composited desktop in general annoys me because it slows me down. Some people will say, you get efficiency through shortcuts and nice things in the desktop that make it faster.
You get used to working around the slowness.
Yeah, or something. But I find, like, if I'm playing a game, you can tell the frame rate of a game is slowed down by okay. the other 3D stuff going on the desktop. That doesn't help.
I might try the 2D thing just to see if it's all right.
Yeah, it is. It is all right. I mean, it's functionally very similar. You have the same keyboard shortcuts. You have the same kind of view with the launcher on the left-hand side. So it's not like it looks different.
Okay.
It looks pretty much identical. You can tell the effects are different, you know, okay. no blurring and fading and stuff like that. But you can probably do without that, because the whole point of Unity, in some people's eyes, is to get out of the way and get you to your applications faster. So arguably, it doesn't matter if you're using 3D or 2D, you want it to go away so you can use your application.
I suppose if it's running fast enough, it blurs so subtly that you get the effect without being disrupted, whereas I guess on, say, this netbook, it's a bit slow.
Yeah, yeah.
And you've got the option of the GNOME 3 desktop in
with GNOME Shell, is that
yes,
right?
Yes, you can. You can
use GNOME Shell.
Yeah, you can install it. It's not on the CD by default.
Yeah.
And
is it in the official repositories or is it
yes.
in the, right, okay.
So with 1104 you had to add it on with a PPA.
Yeah.
And because 1104 was based on GNOME 2 and GNOME Shell is based on GNOME 3, it was a real bit of work
yeah.
to get it to work on 1104, and it would break stuff. Mm. And there was all these warnings saying, don't put this on your machine, you will break it. And then people put it on, broke it, and then complained. Yeah. So now you can actually install it from the repository and it works.
So I suppose if you've got a 3D accelerated desktop, you're all right for GNOME Shell and you're all right for Unity 3D.
Yes.
And KDE. If you want.
Oh, yeah, that one. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, Mark, what's new in KDE in 1110?
Moving on.
Is it more blue?
I think it might be a bit less blue. I don't know. Oh.
Interesting about colours, actually. Moving back to Unity. When you open the dash, which is the big box where you type, where you search for stuff, it has a transparency effect.
Oh, yeah.
And the background colour changes depending upon what colour you've got on your desktop. Mm. So the predominant colour of whatever photo or picture you've got. And it actually really makes quite a nice difference that you don't have, it's not always orange. It's whatever colour is the predominant colour of your desktop already. It's quite nice.
There's a new login screen as well.
LightDM.
So this is replacing GDM, the GNOME Desktop Manager. No, sorry, GNOME Display Manager, which was the old login screen.
Yes.
And this is LightDM.
Presumably it's faster.
Is it lighter?
Shiny?
I don't know.
Does it let you...
You know, you see it, you type your password, you press enter.
I have to
what
say...
What more is there to do?
Does it support ICC colour profiles in the login screen?
I have no idea.
Can you put a pointless picture of a flower there by your name just to show that it's you?
I don't think it does pictures, actually.
All right.
I have a feeling you don't get the avatars. But I know there was the guy who develops it, I think, works for Canonical, and he put a video on YouTube a month or so back that was like a prototype of something you could do with LightDM. And it had these three-dimensional modelled people walking around with a little name tag above their
like
head.
A Wii
like the thing on the Mii, you know,
people
walking around and you click on your person, your little avatar, and that's you. And it was just like illustrating, you know, you wouldn't want to do that, and all the comments were like, why would you do this?
That's quite cute.
Yeah, it is. Yeah,
for three or four people, a family or whatever, who share a computer, that's fine. Wouldn't try doing it in a 10,000 seat
where am I? No, get out of the way. Move. Yeah, that would be weird.
Nice to see new developments in that sort of area, though.
Yeah.
And there's some new sort of updated packages. LibreOffice is landing version 3.4.3.
Yeah, this is all at the end of the list, the kind of, loads of updated stuff, which is all the stuff from upstream that makes Ubuntu what it is, of course. But.
And Firefox 7, and hopefully a new version of Chrome or Chromium as well.
I get Chromium from upstream.
Yeah, you always... Chrome. Isn't there all... isn't Chromium always updating itself?
Chrome is. Chromium
oh, really?
Does not.
I didn't know that.
Because Chrome is updated by Google, but Chromium is the repackaged, fully open source version when it's dependent on the distributor to do it. So when I log into WordPress now, it says, your browser is out of date on my Ubuntu laptop.
Because it thinks it's Chrome.
Because it thinks it's an old version of Chrome.
Right.
And it probably is out of date. I should really look into that. That might be a problem. I just thought it was a silly message. And Linux 3.0, so the kernel's taken the bump to the 3.0 version number.
Yeah, and they've also backported, as they usually do, some stuff from a later, so it's like 3.0.15 or something, whatever they've backported some of that in as well, because there was some driver updates and fixes. So it's not vanilla 3.0 as usual.
Just to go back on the Firefox thing, now that Firefox are doing a release every other day, is Ubuntu going to be backporting those into the current release, the supported release? Well, because if you've got, say, version 7 in 11.10 as the released version, 6 weeks down the line, it's out of date, there's a new version, and security fixes are only going in the latest version for a Firefox. So are they going to be bringing down 8 and 9 and 10 and up to 15 over the next 3 years?
What they're going to do about that in the main repository. I know there is a Mozilla team at PPA, which is a team within Canonical who repackaged stuff.
Oh, there's a team within Canonical. I thought it was a team within Mozilla who were packaging for Ubuntu.
Well, they might be part of the Mozilla project.
Right, okay.
I don't know exactly who staffs it.
Yeah.
But one of the guys has been doing a lot of that work, Chris Coulson, I think it is.
Mm-hmm.
So when 7 came out, and it was pretty much instantly in 11.10.
Updates since version 5, we've had updates coming in every, almost on release day.
Right.
And Firefox saying, you need to restart me now. Thanks for that. Just like Windows.
Well, 11.04 didn't have Firefox 7. It had an older release. Mm. So they put Firefox 7 in that PPA. So if you're still on 11.04, you can still get the updated with this Mozilla team PPA.
Okay, let's talk email clients.
People still use email clients?
Yeah, it's the web browser, isn't it?
No,
clients, isn't it these days?
Chrome is my email client.
Thunderbird.
So Thunderbird has replaced Evolution. Evolution has been the default email client in Ubuntu since...
forever.
It was a twinkle in Mr. Shuttleworth's eye, and it's always been a source of slight controversy because it's been a slightly heavyweight and some points unreliable email client, but it has it has features that other alternatives haven't, like Thunderbird, such as a full calendaring thing. It's been integrated with the GNOME desktop, all that sort of stuff.
It used to have synchronization with Palm Pilots as well.
And Exchange.
Yeah.
Yes, that's the one reason I'd use Evolution, is to get my university email, which is Outlook, and I have to use the NAF web client, only the server's apparently not new enough for Evolution to recognise it.
Oh dear.
Mm.
Yeah, I use it at work for Novell Groupwise as well.
Yeah, Thunderbird has been touted and argued for at pretty much every UDS for, since the first release.
Yeah.
And
I remember. Make it look any nicer.
Well, it does look pretty nice. From Thunderbird 3 upwards, I think it looks pretty much better.
It's been a while.
Pretty good.
Yeah. It still does that very slow indexing thing where it tries to download every mail you've either received, sent, or deleted and indexes them for search functionality. But once
it gets, isn't it?
It is good, but it slows the system right down. Particularly, in my case, I've got a remote IMAP server. So it pulls them all down, indexes them locally, and you end up with a massive kind of cache of those.
Does it just not do that once when you very first set up the account, or does it do that for all your mail every time?
Every time you set up Thunderbird.
Okay.
So if you set up on a new machine.
So it's once per PC.
Once per PC.
That's not so bad.
It's not so bad.
They had a panel of the preview bar. It's massive. It takes up a lot of space.
Doesn't work very well on netbook-sized screens.
It's quite vertically... Yeah.
There are quite a few different options for the headers.
I can't find the word.
Vertically obese.
I don't know. Spacious.
Tall?
Perhaps. Tall.
Capacious. Yes, I think vertically capacious.
But I think it's. I think I'm pleased in general that it's replaced Evolution.
Yes.
Which is quite good.
Yeah, so am I, despite never using an email client.
Font news. What's happening in the land of monospace fonts?
The monospace font is in.
Ooh.
Hooray.
In terminal.
Cool.
Is it done?
Yes and no. So if you open a Ubuntu terminal. GNOME terminal, sorry. You'll see the monospace font, and it looks lovely.
Mm-hmm.
But if you try and set it in the console, so Control Alt F1, it's not the default there.
The actual real console.
Yeah, or on a server. If you're directly attached to a server, it's not the default there. And part of the reason is it looks horrid.
Yeah, it's a much lower resolution on the actual console, isn't it?
Yes. Actually, I thought they'd a few more recent versions. When I switched to the console, it goes in a nice little sort of the same size font I'd have in a terminal window.
Yeah, they use kernel mode switching to get you a nice graphical display in the console.
Hmm.
But the specific problem is the font looks rubbish in that.
Ah,
in that screen.
Right.
I don't know whether it's the conversion to the format for fonts in that size or something, but I spoke to Sladen about it because he's kind of looking after
those things.
Could
be a lack of anti-aliasing or hinting or something.
I don't know what it is. But that's why it's not the default, because it looks
right.
Rubbish.
Good.
But it looks great everywhere else.
Cool.
And Ubuntu One has a new user interface.
Yeah, it's very orange.
Oh.
Is it very different other than being orange?
Well, it's a bit bigger and, you know, it's a bit more, you know, hairy big buttons.
What user interface does Ubuntu One need? Isn't it supposed
There's a client.
The way?
You know, the sign-up thing where you manage your subscriptions to folders and stuff.
Oh, of course, yeah.
Kind of thing.
Yeah.
And choose whether you want certain folders synchronized or
yes,
not.
Yes, okay. You can tell I don't use it.
And it's got parity with the Windows version as well. We mentioned the Windows version last time. Yeah, we did.
Oh, that's good.
That's quite good.
Yeah.
Okay, George Castro in the #Ubuntu-UK-podcast IRC channel on Freenode tells me that Chromium is updated, but it's just behind behind the times a bit.
Cool.
Yeah, it says in our notes here, multi-arch.
Yes.
Is this ARM and stuff?
No.
It's like McDonald's.
You know, we have 32-bit. Version and the 64-bit version of Ubuntu.
Yep.
And one of the problems is if you install the 64-bit version and you want to run 32-bit applications, say, for example, a proprietary application like Flash or Skype or something else, there's this horrible bunch of libraries that get pulled in order to kind of emulate that 32-bit environment to make that work. And it's a bit horrid and it's a bit buggy. So Debian and Ubuntu are both now, as of Natty, I think the tools are capable of being multi-arch, which means you can go, if you're sat on a 64-bit machine, you can go apt-get install package name :i386.
Uh-huh.
And it'll install the 386 version on your 64-bit system and run that.
Does that mean if I download a .deb that's just 386, I can install that as well?
I think so, yeah.
Cool, because the Amazon MP3 downloader is 386
right,
only.
Right, yes. So if you install that, that probably has some dependencies, and that... Those dependencies, when you do the apt-get install bit, you'll see them listed in the apt-get install with :i386 after them.
Okay,
because
cool.
It figures out that they're 386 libraries. And it's not just Intel stuff. Other chips like PowerPC, if we had a PowerPC,
they have
32-bit and 64, and so does MIPS. And so multi-arch is not an Intel thing. It's a 32 versus 64-bit.
Okay,
thing.
And that applies across different chipset families.
Yes. And it applies more to Debian than us because they are available on lots of different architectures.
Okay, well, why not send us in your feedback about what your favourite feature in 1110 is? It should be out by the time you send us an email. Send it to...
Quick, send
please.
One now. Send one now, quick. Maybe they'll release early.
Send it to podcast@ubuntu-uk.org.
It's time for the news. The Blender Foundation has launched Project Mango, the next project to create a short animated film to show off its Blender software capabilities as a professional 3D animation tool. The theme of the project is sci-fi in Amsterdam. That could go one of very many ways.
You say that and I immediately think of Zalior.
I was thinking of the cantina in Star
Wars.
Star Wars.
I knew he said Star Trek then and that would have got us a lot of feedback.
Geek credits.
Blogger, Free Software Guy and former Free Software Foundation member Larry Caffiero has called for the foundation to be forked and a new organisation founded that is a more flexible and more responsible organisation that marries today's technological realities to the possibilities and necessities. After further discussion of the issue, he has concluded this change of leadership is the most important factor to bring the FSF back to relevance.
So what triggered this then?
I don't know.
It was something Richard Stallman said about Steve Jobs being, or Richard Stallman quoting someone else.
Oh, was
right.
He?
You know, something along the lines of, I'm not glad he's dead, but I'm glad he's gone.
That's got to put Richard Stallman in a bit of a bind, isn't it? Because it's somebody enforcing their right to fork versus him taking away from the Free Software Foundation. Talk about a conflict of interests.
The Time Zone Database, a project providing free time zone data used in Java and Unix-like systems, among others, is under attack from Astrolabe, a company who recently purchased ACS Atlas, from which some of the database may be derived. While Arthur David Olson and Paul Eggert, who maintain the database, are currently facing personal lawsuits, the database continues to be maintained by the community.
Well, that's bad, obviously, someone going after them. Are they their astrology company?
Yeah, they're not even like proper scientists.
No, they're not even proper people. Losers.
Their website is rubbish.
It is. It looks like GeoCities, doesn't
yes.
it?
Yes.
It's properly rubbish.
Front Page Express.
Yes. Well, we'll have to hope that they sort out their legal issues. But as always, the community works around the problem.
Yeah, hopefully the community will support them with their lawsuit as well.
Yeah.
Fund lawyers. Kerry Facer of Manchester Metropolitan University, interesting spelling of Metropolitan we have there, has written a blog post requesting input into what could become a new BBC Micro project, a project run by the BBC to promote interest and understanding in the areas of computing and computational thinking.
Cool. This is good, isn't it?
Because it's a good idea. Yeah.
When I was at school, that's when the BBC first came out, the BBC Micro being a beige computer that was really
awesome. Had one of them.
They were still around when I was at school. But
When I was at school, we learnt how to import a CSV file into Microsoft Access.
It's gone downhill since then. Kids, my kids at school, they play games, educational software, but I know the older kids, it's how to use Word, Excel, PowerPoint. Yeah. Yeah. It's not proper analytical skills.
We learnt how to draw lines to make a square using BASIC. The most useful
logo.
Thing. No. I'm not sure. It was some kind of IT class.
Actually, it reflects on what the CEO of Google was saying the other week, wasn't it, about British school children needing to learn computer science rather than ICT.
Mm. Absolutely. Couldn't agree more.
Alan.
Yes, me. Fans of one-handed surfing may be frustrated to learn that the government is planning to introduce porn filters. Customers will have to opt in to access Smut Online and if the current proposals go ahead. Sorry, I got a bit flustered there.
Wave of panic.
Oh, dear.
Laura spotted a flaw with this.
What?
Because it's whole household. So if you've got children and you want to stop children accessing anything questionable, I guess, then the whole household suffers.
Well, yeah, okay, so there's a few things. One is this is only for new accounts. So and it's only so far for the four big ISPs, BT, TalkTalk, Virgin, and
other.
Another one.
Yeah.
Yes, that whatever one. That is. And even if you are affected by it, you can opt out.
Oh, yeah.
Sky.
That's the fourth one, is it? So you can opt out and then implement your own measures.
Yeah.
Which is what I've done. I've got parental controls on the PC. And other people I know use OpenDNS for this kind of stuff. But it is the thin end of the wedge. It is implementing...
Exactly.
It's restrictions on what you can see on a connection.
It's not the government's job to mandate this, is it? No. It's, if you've got kids, it's your job to make sure that, they're not... growing up warped and
problem is,
mentally horrified.
I think the problem is there are some parents out there who have no clue and they'll put a PC in their kid's bedroom from the age of four and not realise that that's an open gateway to, free access to lots of very useful and informative information which may be very good for their upbringing, but equally some pretty nasty stuff they shouldn't be seeing.
And this is why we need better computing education in schools.
Exactly.
Ooh, full circle.
And we have some events. The Ubuntu release party is happening in London this Thursday at The Cask from 6:30 p.m. Do not go at a.m.
That's the Ubuntu UK release party.
Yes, there are other release parties. And there's others in the UK. I think there's one in Leeds, maybe one in Nottingham as well.
Brilliant.
But the London one's a big one.
Yeah, it sounds like there's going to be a lot of people going.
Yeah, there's a load of... I think Jono's flown over from America just to come and buy me a drink.
Am I right in saying that he said he was going to pay for the drinks for the evening?
Yes, he did. Yeah, yes, he said exactly that.
from all the heavy money he's making from Severed Fifth,
I think. Yeah. Yeah, it's a new paradigm in music.
Yeah. London Installfest is happening on the 16th of October, which is about 4 or 5 days away.
Yeah, the weekend.
Yeah, so John Stevenson has reserved an area in the Shooting Star, which is in Middlesex Street in London, on Sunday 16th. Doors open around 12 noon. They have Wi-Fi, and they're not that busy on a Sunday. So you can go along there and install Ubuntu or help other people install Ubuntu.
Yeah, sounds good. The weekend immediately after the release, there'll be... people eager to install Ubuntu, upgrade, or fix problems that they've done by installing or upgrading.
And it's in a pub.
That too, yes.
And getting away from the London-centric events, we've got breaking news of FOSDEM, which will be in Brussels.
Oh, good.
Sorry, it's exasperating Tony there.
On the 5th and 6th of February.
Now
now it's time for some command line love. And Andrew McCarthy tweeted us with a command called eat my data.
That doesn't sound good.
Which apparently is a command for running another command, but disabling disk syncing, which makes things happen quicker, but might lose your data if the power goes or something.
So only run this if you really know what you're doing.
Yeah, if you've got a UPS and you need to do a big...
I don't think it's that much of a problem, really. It's a specific... So the problem this is trying to solve is programs are sometimes slow because they're constantly telling the kernel, you need to flush this to disk. Oh, panic, panic, flush this to disk, flush this to disk. When you don't really need to do that because the power isn't that unstable.
Oh, yeah.
And the chances that your machine's going to go fut right at the point when you saved that valuable
tweet, fut,
at that point is quite slim. And the suggestion he gave is, as an example, is Liferia, if that's how you pronounce it.
Yep.
Liferia. Is it? Is it Liferia?
I don't know.
Don't think so. Liferia. Your advice on how to pronounce something.
Liferia.
Yeah, okay. It's an RSS reader. So, you know, what's the worst that could happen if your RSS reader didn't save the status of read RSS items?
You have to read them again.
Oh, no. Disaster.
Yeah, so by disabling these writes, or at least delaying them until they absolutely have to be done, you get a better disk I.O.
Performance.
Performance.
I wonder if it would... I didn't get a chance to test it because I only got this minutes ago.
That's how organized we are.
Yeah, breaking news in a form of
breaking
tweet.
Your systems.
But yes, if listeners would like to let us know... how
it goes.
How much data they lost with data, then
don't blame us.
Yes, don't email us. Email Andrew McCarthy.
Here's hoping it does what it says on the tin.
So John O'Bacon wrote a blog post a few days ago, which came from a discussion at a recent community council meeting that happened last week, where there was some debate about the state of the community and sort of people's motivation, both in terms of the members and leaders and people who might become leaders in the future.
Yes. Yes. So Ubuntu's been around for how many years now? Since 2004. And over that time, Ubuntu has grown. Canonical, the company behind it, has grown to like 400 or 500 employees now. Number of users has grown exponentially. Well, probably not exponentially. It's grown quite well. I'm speculating. We've put in place councils, boards, leadership teams in order to manage that community of contributors and developers,
yep,
and help users get to the right place in the community. Mm-hmm. And it strikes me that actually people's interest is waning a bit, and I'm not sure why.
How have you noticed that? How does it manifest itself?
Well, there's the obvious ones where people blog about how they're leaving Ubuntu to go and use Mint or to go to Debian, and that might be because they don't trust Canonical. It could be that they don't like Unity. Could be they want to contribute upstream, or for whatever reason, you know, people leave the project. But I think that's not the main part. I think it's more there are people who are contributors and how long-term contributors, people who've been in the project for maybe 4, 5, or even 6 years, and I think they may have had enough. maybe finding it hard to find the motivation to carry on.
It is literally the 7-year itch, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah, it is, yeah.
But even the in the first 2 or 3 years of Ubuntu, there were some fairly significant people who were involved in setting up the project who moved on.
Yeah, you're always going to get staff turnover within Canonical. You're always going to get people whose motivations change, people who personal circumstances change.
Lives change, yeah.
Yeah, and I don't think we should strive to keep everyone, because you don't want to keep unhappy contributors and you don't want to try and force people to contribute to your project. But equally, the people who want to contribute or who have a feeling that they might like to contribute, it should be a place that they can contribute and feel happy about what they're doing.
Is this something where on paper it looks like there's a lot being done and a lot happening over the various open weeks that are going on, the various sort of community events, things like the buttons competition and the artwork and various other things that people
not
can...
Not those buttons.
Not, oh, okay, oh, right. Sorry. No, sorry. When Tony mentions buttons, he has that look in his eye and I think he's remembering the moment.
Yeah. I meant the Ubuntu release countdown buttons on the website and things and various other sort of, you know, projects and things that people can get involved in. Mm. But... perhaps it's just the same old faces doing it, and a few of those are going.
It is
and
a lot
not being
of
replaced.
It is some of that. You know, there are the same people. We obviously welcome new contributors, and we would love it when someone who first starts out as a user of Ubuntu and then turns into a developer or turns into a community contributor and maybe gives a talk about something or gives a session at an open week or a developer week or runs an Ubuntu hour, or like John Stevenson we mentioned in the events, takes it upon himself to hire a room in a pub and help people out. But yes, I think you're right. There is an element that there are a number of people who are long-term contributors who've, just had enough.
Do you think new people are possibly intimidated by the fact that it seems to be the same people involved and therefore it seems harder to get in to be part of it?
Yeah, I think there is a part of that, and there's also a part of the barrier to entry might be a bit higher than you would expect and higher than it was 4 years ago.
In what way?
If you want to be, let's say for example, if you want to contribute, you see people chatting away on IRC giving support and you want to help out, there are already a whole bunch of people helping out in there.
Yeah.
And they already know all of the common frequently asked questions, and they often get in there before you do. And so you might be really super keen and eager to help, but it's difficult to do it because there's so many other people who are, for want of a better word, better at it than you because they've been doing it for so long and they've got so much experience.
Or just more confident, Dovin.
Yeah, that too. And also, sometimes you get smacked down by the people who've been doing it a long time. You know, by the neckbeard syndrome. We've been here for ages and we've been doing it. We know how to do it and you're wrong. And I've seen situations of that happening, not just on IRC. That was an example, but there are, in general, it can happen as well. You know, someone joins the art team and says, hey, I've made this logo. Nobody replies. Or one person replies and goes, don't like it. You know, it's hard to get over that barrier. Conversely, there are some places where it is super easy to contribute, like Ask Ubuntu.
Yeah.
Log on to Ask Ubuntu, you get an account for nothing, filter, show all questions that have got no answers, pick one, answer it. You know, there are some ways that are super easy to contribute.
So if you look at the community leaders, and things like the community council is a good place to find that sort of person. I think I'm right in saying in the past, the elections for the community council have been sort of oversubscribed. There have been lots of people who have wanted to stand, and perhaps more people than could effectively be voted for.
Yes.
Whereas this time around, we've had quite a few people stepping down and not wanting to stand for re-election, not choosing to for whatever reason.
Yeah.
And seems to be less interest. Yeah, that's what
I'm getting.
Less
new people have stood as well. Yeah, you're right. Like when I stood 2 years ago, the voting form for, you know, who you want to vote for in the community council election was pretty long. And now it's a lot shorter. I think there's something like seven names or ten. No, it's 11
it's
for seven.
11, I think, yeah.
11 names for seven positions.
So basically, you know, you've got to be doing really badly not to be within a good chance of getting elected.
That's well, yes, but the list of candidates isn't just people who nominated themselves. The nominees for community council, okay, this is very specific, but the way the process works is you nominate yourself or someone nominates you to be elected onto the community council. That goes to the current community council and Mark actually gets the veto. He says, this is the shortlist. Now, last time, I think a few people were knocked off and it was the community council that decided who was knocked off that list and Mark got the final say. This time, Mark just said, they're all good.
Right.
So nobody got knocked off. Nobody got didn't get through that first round of nomination to get to the vote.
Okay.
So that's one specific technicality of the community council. But you've got to remember the community council, the pool of people you're pulling from are people who are already leaders in Ubuntu.
Yeah.
So the people who are already on the IRC council, already a leader within their loco, already a leader somewhere else. And what I'm talking about is not a problem at that level.
Okay.
I'm talking about a problem much further down the chain,
okay,
which is getting people into leadership positions in their local community and their loco and whatever other teams. And not just leaders, but contributors who will then become leaders. I don't think we're fostering new people to become leaders in the community.
Okay, my experience of LUGs and my experience of the Ubuntu UK loco is that generally there aren't a huge number of people who want to be leaders for that sort of thing.
Yeah.
You know, elections are generally uncontested, or maybe there's two people who want to do it out of a group of, say, 100 plus people. So why is it then difficult to get people into those positions if there is such a relatively small amount of people who are willing to do it in the first place?
Why is it hard if there aren't many people? Surely that's answering your question, isn't it?
Well, no, because you only need one to be a leader.
Well, yeah, but the project is growing and we have new teams starting up to do different things. Okay, there's only one team in the UK for UK loco, but it could quite easily happen. I mean, that team has got 500, 700 people in it. It could quite easily be that they say, well, that's too big. Let's break it up a bit and let's turn it into the LUG model where you break it down by a smaller region, whether that's north, south, east and west or state or county or whatever you want to do. You've still got to find some people who have the skills to lead in those areas.
And it's right. Getting more fragmented, and there could be the people who would have been running the LUGs, or people running the LUGs could have been running the LOCOs.
Yeah, and you're right. The community is, whilst it's huge and there's loads of people in it, it's not. It's a lot of people who are quite happy to be told what to do.
Laura Tchaikovsky has just said in the IRC channel that some loco teams apparently have councils and even community managers,
yep,
presumably all volunteers,
yep,
which she finds a bit baffling, but I can see why it'd be useful for a large loco, but also they're apparently able to find people to fulfill those roles.
I've had these discussions with Laura before. There's a very diverse culture across locos, and in some locos like Brazil, they have actually got multiple teams within the Brazilian team.
It's a massive country.
Yes, that's part of it. But equally, you look at the flip side of the UK, we're a pretty chilled out country in terms of, you know, open sourcey stuff. Okay, people get a bit ranty, you know, top posting. But in terms of, you know, we're happy to let someone, you know, take control of the team and go and do their stuff. We don't feel regimented and that we have to have a committee and we have to have this and that structure in place for something which is like 500 or 600 people. Whereas I think there's a cultural difference where in other countries they do feel, and it's also about the personalities. Individuals sometimes feel that they need the support of a council or in order to get a vote of, you know, shall we do this event or shall we focus on something else or do promotion? And they would like to have consensus and agreement rather than having one person dictate what should be done, if that makes sense.
Do you think the size could put some people off? Obviously, it wouldn't put all people off, but it's less cozy and it's more structured now than it probably was 6 years ago.
Yeah. And
the councils and things.
Yeah. And that is certainly intimidating for some new users. And maybe we're making, like I said earlier, the barrier to entry too high for new people. We try and keep it low and we try and say, you know, everyone's welcome. And, you know, and I sit in IRC channels and on mailing lists and I see new people arrive and there are names that I don't recognize and they're giving help and they're offering support and stuff. And I think that's great. And these people may further, you know, in 3 years' time when I'm sitting in my rocking chair and retired and
slippers.
Yeah. Then they'll be leading the team and that'll be great. But
yeah.
But I don't think we're fostering that. I don't think we're doing the right thing to make more people want to do that, and more people want to go through the, for want of a better word, ranks of Ubuntu.
I think just as a sort of general member of the community and nothing more, I think I do agree with that. I don't feel at the moment like I don't feel the drive to become an Ubuntu member to, you know, start joining one of the teams and contributing. I'm quite happy just using it and knowing that there's you know there's other people there doing the hard work for me.
Don't take this the wrong way, but it's part of that because you use Kubuntu.
It could be, but I suppose, I mean, I'm still involved. I go in the Kubuntu IRC channel, I give support. But yeah, I mean, I could still become involved in the Kubuntu side of it,
yeah.
But I don't feel the need to. I don't feel like there's much that I need to do or that I would enjoy doing at the moment. Whereas
Which is interesting because you are someone who has an immense amount of skill.
Hmm.
That could be, I'm not trying to lay guilt trip on you, but I'm putting you forward as an illustration of the kind of person who could do lots of really great things in the Ubuntu community, but self-selects them out.
Well, I mean, a few years ago, I think had I had the time to, I might have been more interested in doing it, but it's sort of the atmosphere. I think you're right that the atmosphere has changed recently around like the community, and it doesn't feel like something which I want to, you know, push myself into at the moment, whereas in the past That's it might have been. It felt more exciting before, whereas at the moment it just feels like, you know,
is that because we've reached that point? We haven't what, as Mark calls it, like leapt over the chasm and got, you know, Joe normal user or all of the Joe normal users using it, but we've got to that point where It's the place where Lugs were a little while ago, where Lugs started to wane because people didn't actually have that much trouble installing Linux.
Yeah.
And now Ubuntu's got
people,
to the point.
People know what Ubuntu is.
Yeah.
You can say Ubuntu to someone and they won't look at you like you've just said something in Afrikaans.
Well, many people will, but we've certainly got a certain, I don't know.
There's a certain chance that they might have heard of it, even if they don't really know what it is.
Exactly. That's what I'm trying to say.
But then that advocacy is only one part of, you know, what we do, you know, there's plenty of other things.
So what can Ubuntu do to be fostering the future leaders?
Well, it's interesting you ask. Jono sent out this survey to all Ubuntu members, and I believe he's processing the results, and that will be difficult this week because it's release week, so sure. He and everyone else at Canonical is madly busy. So I would expect within the next week or two for Jono to summarize some of that in a blog post and tell us what other people think of you know, how we can improve this.
I'm sure there'll be a lot of discussion about it at UDS as well in the community track.
I hope so, yeah.
But you know, do you think Ubuntu should be having some sort of perhaps informal program to spot people who could be useful in the long term to the Ubuntu project and communicate?
Well, actually, Amber Grainer has kicked off a new team, which is all about developing leaders, because people aren't necessarily naturally leaders, or they might be, but
they don't want to put themselves forward.
Exactly. So Amber's set up a new leadership team. We'll put a link in the show notes to help people and foster people towards that leadership if they want it. And that's certainly a part of it. I don't know if that's the whole solution.
Okay, well, if you have perceived any changes in the Ubuntu community over the last 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years...
Keep counting.
Yeah, I can do it. I'll take my shoes and socks off in a minute. Then why not email in to podcast@ubuntu-uk.org or get in touch with us via any of the other methods that we'll mention at the end of the show.
Now it's time for a bit more about Ubuntu.
So we did that.
So Mark Shuttleworth has announced that Ubuntu 12.04 LTS will be called the Precise Pangolin.
What precisely is a pangolin?
It's an armoured anteater.
Okay. Right.
Have we not had some kind of anteater before?
We've had a warthog.
What was...
That's not some kind of anteater.
No. Fair enough.
Okay. I thought there was something. We had an
I felt so.
I would say aardvark, but that was wrong.
No.
Okay.
Do herons eat ants? I don't know. So it's not just us, though, that have the odd names.
Oh, yeah.
Fedora have just announced that Fedora 17 is going to be the beefy miracle.
They've actually gone with it, haven't they?
Yes.
Yes.
And they because of their naming convention, unlike Ubuntu's naming convention, which is Mark chooses it, with Fedora, it's you have to have some kind of link between the next release code name and the previous release code name. And the last one, I can't remember what the last one was, but the tenuous link they gave the beefy miracle to the previous one was The Beefy Miracle and the other one were candidates for the previous release name, which is somewhat meta. But,
oh, right, okay, yes.
I thought that was quite good.
Yeah, tenuous to say the least, I think.
Yeah, just a bit.
Colin Watson has posted a summary of the top 10 Ubuntu brainstorm ideas and the responses to them.
Yeah, it's an interesting write-up of some of these ones.
Yeah, it's been a program over the last year or two, I think. I think Matt Zimmerman kicked it off to try and get more feedback because we have this thing called Brainstorm. I think we mentioned it way back on the very first show.
Pretty much, yeah.
I think it was the first show we thought about maybe having a segment where we talk about the best Brainstorm things. I think we just talked about it once.
Yeah.
And never looked at it again.
4 years later.
Well, a lot of people find a way to, you know, tell us what they think we should do with Ubuntu.
There's a nice one in here about adjusting the volume for your headphones automatically when you plug them in. So if you need the volume on your headphones lower than you do for your internal speakers, when you plug things in, they should automatically adjust.
Yeah.
And apparently it does actually work in 1110 for some people.
See, that's what's good, is sometimes the answer is, actually, we've already done that.
Yeah.
Yeah. It is really cool to see, like, these ideas not just sitting there. You know, someone says, oh, this would be brilliant, and then it just sits on a website. It's actually seeing the responses and things coming out of them.
Yeah, if you focus on just what the faults are all the time, you're just going to end up with something that works but isn't particularly amazing, whereas some of these things could really make a difference to people. Okay, community ne'er-do-well Alan Pope has blogged about the Ubuntu Community Council elections. 11 candidates are standing for 7 available seats, and Ubuntu members should be receiving emails with details about voting soon.
It's already gone out, I think.
It has, yeah. I've had mine. I voted.
Yes, so did I. It's a really complicated voting system, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, and the fact that you go to the webpage and you can either click and drag people, or you can use up, down, left, right arrows, or you can use drop-down numbers.
I think they're going
really
for maximum accessibility.
Yes.
What did you do? Did you press the buttons up and down, or did you drag people?
Combination of...
No, I did the drop-downs.
I felt a sense of satisfaction grabbing someone and dragging them to the bottom of the list.
Oh, I won't ask who...
Sorry. I also had similar satisfaction dragging Daniel Holbach to the top of the list.
He's a very nice guy.
Yes.
Where was Laura Chukoski?
In the list.
Oh, you're going to get in trouble. Tell us.
I knew you were going to ask me that. Community manager Johnny Bacon is surveying, we've mentioned this, Ubuntu members about the community, its strengths and weaknesses, and we'll put a link in the show notes.
Okay.
HP has chosen Ubuntu as the primary host and guest OS for its public cloud based on the OpenStack architecture.
Cool.
Okay, this is really interesting information for people who like clouds and stuff.
So, Mark, what's OpenStack?
I thought we deleted the OpenStack.
No, that was a different one.
Oh, that was the other OpenStack.
As I understand it,
that was the more boring
OpenStack
one.
Is basically a way of someone setting up their own Amazon EC2-like system.
Yeah, and it was Rackspace, I think.
And Rackspace.
And NASA. Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah, that was odd.
And Rackspace have said they're going to... promise to offload it to the community rather than control it internally.
That's good.
I mean,
a nice
foundation, yeah. Offload it in a nice
so
way.
They
not
have
kick it out of the car while it's at 90 miles an hour.
Like Nivelle.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh. Yeah.
Works, okay.
Yeah.
Well, it's really good news that Ubuntu is going to be the main place for that. And apparently Canonical and HP are working together on that one.
Yep.
Cool. And not about Ubuntu, the OpenSUSE for ARM hardware project has launched a donation drive to raise funds, allowing them to buy ARM boards to be used for debugging. The target is to raise a princely €1,000.
Currently at 220 euros.
Yeah. I think this is an excellent idea for them to buy some... Because one of the problems with ARM hardware is, you need it to be able to compile your stuff for ARM hardware, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And... they need some to be able to build OpenSUSE.
It's one of those things where they have build farms. You know, they have ancient old servers of obscure architectures. Debian has them. For particular architectures living in a data center somewhere, probably in a university data center.
Good luck to them.
Indeed, yes. I hope they make their £1,000.
Euros.
€1,000. What's that? About £10?
And that's all in the bit about Ubuntu this week.
Time for your feedback. Keith Drummond, friend of the show, commented, everyone's a friend of my show. Oh, did I say mine? Whoops. I'm thinking out loud again.
I think Amy Ferguson would disagree.
Anyway, edit that out. Keith Drummond commented on Google Plus.
Just finished listening. Another great show. Thank you. But surprised nobody mentioned Deja Dupe, especially with it going default. I used Back in Time, but switched to Deja Dupe earlier this year. Maybe something for the next pre-1110 show?
Oh!
What's you mean by going default?
There's actually a default install.
7 years on, we've put a backup tool on the CD.
Oh.
Yeah, fancy that.
There we go. So it's any good?
Yes. I looked into it and it seems pretty good.
It's what I use on my mum's machine, my mum Ubuntu machine. Okay. She's got an external USB hard drive and Deja Dupe just sits there. And it uses, under the covers, it uses something called Duplicity, which does the incremental kind of backup thing, leave it running and, you know.
Oh, I might try that.
It's pretty good, actually. It's worth a go. It's better than that one you tried previously, S Backup.
Yeah, that especially so, because that one stops running now. You have to actually manually start it to make it do the backup.
Oh, dear. Keen Minecrafter Ian Big Calm Cuthbertson commented,
backing up, RDIF backup from here to my parents' place, and my parents' backup to here with RDIF backup. Recursive problems there. Revision-based backups.
Disks filled up really quick.
Revision-based backups mean you don't have to worry about keeping extra day, week, month, year versions. Alan, with your Dropbox woes, you could have restored the missing files via the web interface.
Yeah, you weren't the only person to mention that, Ian. Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, it's good when you're wrong, because we've got lots of email.
Had I been here, I could have told him that. Because I've just got a Dropbox Pro account.
Have you really?
Oh. Yes.
Not Ubuntu One?
Well, I was using Ubuntu One, but you can't, as far as I can work out, access the files from the web interface.
Yeah, you can.
Yeah, you can.
Well, I couldn't.
One.ubuntu.com/files.
I couldn't find it. All it does is show you the directories that are synced. You can't click into them.
Yeah, you can.
Yeah.
No, you can't. However, you can undelete files on Dropbox.
Can someone please email in and point out that Laura is wrong?
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. I've paid for a year now.
Okay. You've got 12 months to email in.
David Taylor emailed to say,
love the show.
Thank you, David.
I was just listening to your chat on backups and felt you were a little unfair to Dropbox. Interestingly, Dropbox keeps revisions of files, so you can roll back if you've been an idiot.
Indeed.
Can't be an idiot.
I used to take care of my Android development files. If I accidentally delete or overwrite something, I can log into the website and download an older version. I hope Ubuntu One works like this too, although I haven't looked into it.
I couldn't work it.
I'm sure I won't be the only one correcting you with this, so apologies if there were 1,000 of us. I found the discussion very interesting otherwise, smiley face.
Aw, thank you.
Yep.
And so, everyone else.
Yep.
No, Ubuntu One doesn't have revisions.
No.
No.
It just has the current version on the website that you can find via 1.ubuntu.com/files.
Which is specifically what I was looking for.
Yes. Christian Frisk on Facebook said,
Heard your last podcast in which you discussed about different backup solutions. Do you know about Backup 2L? It's what Bytemark.co.uk used by default, so that's why I learned it. But now, I certainly don't regret it. It's my default for backing up almost everything nowadays.
Backup 2L, what's the L?
It's just a lowercase L.
Yeah, but what does the L mean? Usually two. Number two.
Well, it says it's a lightweight or low maintenance tool, so maybe
so it's backup two, the lightweight version, not backup two thing that begins with L.
No, it's backup two, the number two, L.
Right.
The letter L.
Yeah, I was trying to deconstruct that and find out what that meant.
Yeah, I haven't done enough research.
It's not like PDF to text, if that, I think that's
That's what I thought, yes.
See, I haven't done enough research to find out why that is.
That man said.
It's a great command line tool that has screenshots, which are just terminal.
Excellent.
I know, exactly, but it's always amusing.
It kind of proves it.
Yeah.
And finally, a little something from the Wing Commander.
Uh-oh.
Wing Commander, Sir Arthur Curmudgeon here. Heard your last show whilst sipping me gin and tonic in the drawing room. You were talking about things that get your back up. Newspaper delivery boys, plastic milk bottles, Piers Morgan. Bah! If I start on all the topics that get my back up, well, your show's just not long enough. Like, electronic voting. How am I supposed to go into the voting booth and spoil my paper if all I've got to vote with is a mouse button? You know, writing none of the above, or fake candidates' names, or just plain drawing a big dangler on the ballot paper. A hanging chad, I believe they call it. Don't get me started, as my nephew says. The other thing in the show was the reference to losing your cat in an horrific clipboard accident. Well, blow me down. I didn't realize it was that common a problem. You should do what I did and give the old moggy a decent send-off. I toasted mine. I mean, any excuse for a gin and tonic, eh? Cheers, bottoms up, as they say in the rugby. Yours, the WC.
I think he needs less gin, or maybe more.
I think Alan's leaking from his face. That was one of the best ones for a while, I think, on the Wing Commander front. I enjoyed that one.
Me too.
And that's all of your feedback. That's all for this episode. Thank you for listening. You can find out how to get in touch with us on our website, podcast.ubuntu-uk.org, including voicemail numbers and Twitter feeds, Facebook and IRC channels. Let us know what you think of the show, or give us your thought about Ubuntu and the community around it, especially prescient given the conversation we had earlier in the show.
Yeah, we wrote that for a reason, you know.
Yeah. So join us on Tuesday the 25th of October for our next live episode. Have you had fun, everybody?
Yes.
Is it time for cake?
Yes.
Tea and cake.
What cake have we got?
We have Fiendish Fancies.
Are they like French fancies, but scary?
They're Halloween.
Are they a chili? Oh, okay.
I don't know why they're scary, apart from when somebody throws them at you across the room.
It could be arranged.
Incoming!
Yeah, so let's get the
Halloween.
Let's get the kettle on. See you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.